You're listening to the A Minute to Midnight show. This is Tony, and on today's show we have Nick Kios returning. Nick is very well learned with biblical studies, theology and philosophy, and also if you have any sort of interest in biblical archaeological discoveries, then today's show should be a really good one for you to enjoy. We welcome Nick Kios back to the A Minute to Midnight show. We had Nick on once late last year, and it's really nice to have you back on again today, Nick.
Thank you, Tony, for having me. Always a pleasure.
And I believe you've had some pretty interesting adventures since we last spoke, and some important archaeological endeavors amongst that. So perhaps you could tell the listeners what that is all about.
Yeah, Dr. Stephen Collins of Trinity Southwest University in New Albuquerque, Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's been heading up a dig now for 12 seasons, 12 years in Jordan. And as you know, Israel is, of course, the number one spot for biblical research, archaeological remains, and history. But right on the other side of the Jordan River, you have Jordan. And that would be the second largest area as far as early antiquity within Judea, Israel, HaYordan or Jordan. And I am participating there in what's known as the Tal el Hammam dig. And we believe that to be the ancient site known as Sodom in the scriptures.
And so what makes what makes you believe that it's Sodom?
Quite a few things. There are, if you know, the traditional location is located at the southern end of the Dead Sea. So there's two possible areas. Traditionally, you know, at least since the 1980s, some scholars have gone with an area known as Bab Ed Dra. It's spelled B-A-B-E-D-H-D-H-R-A. And that's at the southern end of the Dead Sea. And now, of course, Collins have been excavating at the northeast part of the Dead Sea, which is typically about 8.5 mile stretch northeast from the northern tip of the Dead Sea. So there are two locations, and William F. Albright, that is a big name. He's no longer with us. In 1924, he believed that Sodom was located somewhere at the southern end of the Dead Sea. But that being said, he didn't believe that the site known as Bab Ed Dra is the or was the genuine location. He dismissed that area. Tal el Hammam is the new kid on the block. And I'm going to say roughly around 2013 is when it became known as the second site known to be Sodom or believed to be Sodom. And like I said, Dr. Stephen Collins is heading up that dig. Very interesting area. We, you know, both areas have experienced fire, you know, tremendous fire. But you will see that throughout the plains of Jordan as well. You know, it wasn't just Sodom that God destroyed. It was Gomorrah as well. There are other smaller cities near the southern end of the Dead Sea. But this site that some scholars believe to be Sodom, I'm talking about the southern site now, no, there really wasn't a heavy occupation. Some say no inhabitants ever lived there. We can go back and forth on those. But, you know, when you want to establish a biblical site, you know, you have to ask key questions. You know, what was the date of the occupation? When did people inhabit the place or the city? You know, what does the biblical text say? You know, is there any archaeological evidence in favor of the site? And of course, what do the locals say? Do we have any tradition that would advocate that this is the area. Now, Tal el-Hammam is that area after it was destroyed, roughly in the Middle Bronze Age era. I'm going to say somewhere between 1600 and 1700 BC. So that's almost 3,800 years ago. Nobody would set foot in this general area where we are digging. For some 700 years, it remained completely unoccupied since the last occupation. Now, the people of Sodom were not the last occupation that lived there. You know, you have other, you kind of have to count backwards. When we say late Bronze Age, that would be before, or that would be after, say, the early Bronze Age. So we actually have civilizations going back as far as what's known as the Chalcolithic era, and that's about 4,500, 4,600 BC to about 3,600 BC. So almost 1,000 years, 4,600, 3,600 BC, that would be the Chalcolithic era. And you can tell on the construction of floors, walls, they were different from, say, Intermediate Bronze Age or Late Bronze Age mud bricks, which we have everywhere at this site. And then that takes you up to the Iron Age. And then, of course, the Hellenistic Age, about 300 to about 60 BC. So there is occupation of various periods, so to speak. What we're after is evidence of the Middle Bronze Age. So to get to that point, you have to dig deeper and deeper and deeper. You have to go through, say, the Hellenistic period. Then you have the Iron Age. You have Iron Age 1, 2A, 2B, and 2C. And Iron Age 1 would be 1200 BC to about 1000 BC, 200 years, all the way down to Iron Age 2, which is 700 to about 580 or 586 BC. So you're kind of plowing through all of that, Tony, to get down to the Middle Bronze Age when we believe this city was destroyed. It is the biggest city in the plains of the Jordan. I mean, it's a huge, what you would call typically in archaeology, if you go to Israel, you would call it a mound. In those days when you say a new occupation came in after, say, the Canaanites, you wouldn't have bulldozers and bobcats removing the foundation. You would just build right on top of it. So sometimes when you're driving around in Israel, you look to your right and you go, wow, that's an interesting hill. It's kind of covered with grass and you think it's a hill or a small mountain. You walk up to it and kind of touch it and look around, you actually see strata of different periods. So they would just build on top of other civilizations, rubbish, and the mound would just get bigger and bigger. In Israel, typically you would call these areas a tel, or a mound, the city. Tel Hazar, for example, or Tel Jericho. On the Jordanian side, because of Arabic, they would call it Tal, T-A-L-L, Tal El Hammam, or they would actually say Tal Al Hammam. So having said that, we were digging through quite a bit of strata to get down to the Middle Bronze Age, and we found pottery remains, a lot of sherds. We've even found layers of ash, and that's when things get interesting. But you've also found ash layers at the southern site.
So just interrupting for a second, how far apart are those two sites in terms of distance?
Oh, I'm going to say, gosh, you can see the Dead Sea. Like I said, just think, if you're standing at the northern tip of the Dead Sea, northeast, 8 miles. The Dead Sea isn't that big. So, I mean, you can see on a clear day the southern tip or the southern end of the Dead Sea. It's not that big. It's not really an ocean or a sea. It's really a lake, because the Jordan River dead ends into the Dead Sea, and it's the lowest point of the earth, which is why the salinity is so high. There's really no outlet, you know, in and out water. There's just water going down through the Transjordan or through the Jordan River, and it dead ends into the Dead Sea. So I don't want to say miles because I don't know how many miles, but I'm going to say as far as driving, it wouldn't be more than tops 45 minutes, tops an hour.
So potentially they could have both been hit at the same time, is that? And destroyed at the same time, would that be right?
Well, yes and no. It would be. Let me back up a little bit. You have to wrap your head around the Middle Bronze Age, or you have to go back a little later. You know, we would say, biblically speaking, around 1700 BC. Is when Tal el Hamam was destroyed, or when Sodom was destroyed. Now, there are some controversies surrounding, how long did the patriarchs live? What was the time frame of the Exodus? And other factors that come into play, dating of the Exodus, because you can go with an earlier date, you can go with a later date on the Exodus journey. So, how literal are these numbers? We know the Bible uses rounded numbers, etc. I don't want to get into that because it's a distraction. They can pick up Stephen Collins and Scott. They wrote a book called Discovering the City of Sodom. Very good piece where they actually go through digs that I were not on, you know, past seasons, so to speak. But let me back up a little bit. We have to start with the scriptures, and then we want to look at the occupations, and then you want to get into what traditions have to say, etc. Let me just back up a little bit. When it says in the scriptures in Genesis that God was raining down fire and brimstone, what's very interesting about this particular site is they found layers of ash. You know, there's scientists that participates in this. Some of the sherds or pottery will go to the Jordanian antiquities. Scientists will test ash, and they can tell at what temperature this ash was consumed, if you will. So you have layers of ash roughly being the result of, say, 1500 to maybe 1600 degrees. But there's also layers of ash that have been affected by 15,000 to 20,000 degrees. Now, that is really cool stuff, because how can they tell? Well, say, for example, if we had a piece of pottery and you heated that up to about 20,000 degrees, that piece is almost going to, the clay would almost turn into glass. And if this occurred for more than a second, it would be completely consumed. So what's interesting here is scientists are saying that whatever hit this site at the lower Tal, the lower city, imagine you have an upper walled city, like a flat mountain or a mound or a hill, and then it sort of slopes down on one side into a lower Tal, a lower city, and then below that, there are other places where people could live. You would have the city gate, where Lot's at, etc., maybe bathhouses and so forth. They found Roman bathhouses below the lower part of the city. But in any event, whatever hit this city hit it so hard and so fast for no longer than a second, Tony. No longer. So imagine whatever means God used. Could be lightning, some sort of fire, brimstone. Can look into what those words mean in the Hebrew and go back and forth, but he rained fire down and it hit the lower part of the city, blew up the mountain going up the slope, and then just level the upper part of the city. I guess two skeletal remains is all they found. Everything else was consumed. And this was an older lady and a younger lady that were actually cooking. They could tell that they were in some type of a kitchen. And the parapet walls, or the walls between, they were standing between, you know, four walls. Well, the wall to the right just blew over them and sandwiched them between the left wall. And then the fire came over him. It didn't consume him because the mud brick or the walled structure protected their corpses or their skeletons. So everything else was consumed. What blew my mind was, how do scientists, what makes them say it only took, you know, a second for all of this to happen? Had it happened any longer, like I said, that piece of pottery that is now almost glass, because of 15 to 20,000 degrees, it would have been completely vaporized if it lasted for 2 or 3 or 5 seconds. So it hit it instantaneously so fast and so hard that nothing breathing or living would have survived. That's what's very interesting about this site. I don't think they found evidence like that at the southern tip or the southern end. But that being said, in Genesis 10, some of the earlier proponents of the southern location, to get back to what you were asking about, they're arguing that Genesis chapter 10 implies that Sodom must be located somewhere southeast, southern end of the Dead Sea. But then again, you could read Genesis chapter 10, I believe it's verse 19. If you read 19 literally, you could say that this is just a passage that sort of defines the bordering area of Canaan, you know, east and west. It sort of lays out the boundaries of ancient Canaan. So I wouldn't say jump the wagon and say this is evidence that it's at the southern end. You could just say it's just describing the Canaanite boundaries as far as it stretches, etc. But that being said, William F. Albright and others were somewhat convinced that the city must have been located south or southeast somewhere because of slime pits, tar pits, you know, sinkholes you might have heard about. If you go to the Dead Sea, there are certain areas you don't want to go to. It'll be not coned off, but it will have warning signs, tar pits, you can sink, and so forth. So these slime pits were pretty impressive in the early, I'm going to say the late 20s, 30s, and 40s. But now if you go to, say, the Dead Sea cave area, the Dead Sea caves at Qumran, there are more slime pits over there in that general region than there is in the southern end. So, you know, where are you going to put your place your bet, so to speak? On top of that, the southern location would be a really, really bad choice to build a city. There's not much stuff growing there. You're at the southern end. It would be very easy to be invaded. And I don't think King Bera of Sodom, the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah, would build a city where they could easily be attacked. It would be very difficult to grow agriculture and do farming and those things. Now, that being said, when we know that Abraham and Lot, they were in Bethel and Ai when they made the deal. Remember, they were arguing our Abraham had his herdsmen and a huge flock, and the same thing with Lot. And they were bickering and arguing, the herdsmen were. And so Abraham says, hey, listen, if you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. What do you want, Lot? We're going to have to separate here. And what did Lot say? From Bethel and Ai, he could see the plains of the Jordan, the plains of the Jordan. And it says that it's comparable to the Garden of Yahweh, to the Garden of God, the Garden of Eden, sort of a reference there, or an example. And this, the plains of Jordan was well watered, like the Garden of Eden or the Garden of the Lord. Or, and it also uses the Nile River, you know, which of course is in Egypt. So at the southern end, it would not be a well-watered area. What Dr. Collins did is he went back to the drawing board years ago, and he looked up the word plain, the plains of the Jordan. And the Hebrew word for plains is kikar, kikar, K-I-K-K-A-R, kikar. So if you say the kikar of Jordan, kikar means disc or something that is round. For example, a loaf of bread or a round bread or a pita bread, that would be round. Or a disc or a CD, that's something round. So kikar is sort of like the disc, somewhat of a circular area of the Jordan. And if you're standing at Bethel and I, and you look east, which is what they did, they were looking east. They're not going to look behind. There's not much behind. There's certainly no well-watered garden. So you got, they're staring at the Jordan River. They can clearly see it. And back then it was well-watered, a lot of little rivers, you know, coming out of the Jordan, traveling left, traveling right. Now it would be on the Israeli side and, of course, over on the Jordanian side. But if you take the plains of the Jordan, it would be sort of like, think of a clock. Let's put Bethel and I, say, at 6 o'clock. And at noon, 12 o'clock, you have the kikar and the disc area, sort of like an oval area. To the right of it, you would have the Dead Sea. And of course, Jordan River would be traveling toward 9 o'clock. So you got the kikar or the plains of the Jordan at noon. Bethel and Ai is where Abraham and Lot is standing, looking at the plains, the kikar, the disc of the Jordan. And, you know, to its right is the Dead Sea. And then to the left, you would have the Jordan River, which would be north. So Lot traveled east, the text says, from Bethel and Ai. And he pitched his tent as far as Sodom. Now, some people or some scholars will say, well, he pitched his tent as far as Sodom. Doesn't mean he lived in Sodom. Well, he moved to Sodom. He sat at the gate of Sodom. That we know. And then, of course, before God destroyed Sodom, he left the city of Sodom. So he didn't leave some other nearby city. At least that's what the text says. So Lot traveled east. He didn't go south. He pitched his tent near Sodom, and then he lived in Sodom. So that's sort of like the geographical test, if you will. I went through Genesis 10 and looked at the Canaan boundaries, and I started off with you know, you have Sidon, you have Tyre, you have Dan, you have Gerar, all the way down to Adma, which would be at the southern end of the Dead Sea. You know, there are other small cities that you could say, well, this is possibly Gomorrah, because it would be, that's another thing, when you're reading in the scriptures, it never mentions Gomorrah standing alone. It always says Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom being named first means it's a bigger city. It would be sort of like the city state, and Gomorrah would be lesser. Now, you can read in other passages where Sodom is mentioned alone. Nowhere else do you see Gomorrah mentioned alone. So it's Sodom and Gomorrah, or just Sodom. Gomorrah is never mentioned alone. So the boundaries, you know, they reached, I'm talking now the Canaan boundaries. It says in verse 19 that the boundaries reached from Sidon toward Gerar as far as Gaza. That would be west. Then from Sodom, Gomorrah, Adman, Zeboyim, as far as Lasha. Okay, if you draw that out in a rectangle, you know, where you have north being Sodom, north being Sidon, right? Tyre right below it. You got the Mediterranean Sea to your left or west, and then east, you would have Sodom, and of course at the southern end you would have the Dead Sea. And from Dan you could draw a line down to the Sea of Galilee, just trying to map out that verse. If you follow that verse and make a drawing, it's more believable that Sodom is right on the other side of the Jordan River, northeast of the Dead Sea, because that's what you would be looking at when they're negotiating who's going to get what, who's going to go where from the city of Bethel and Ai. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it would be handy to actually be able to visualize it. Just one thing I want to ask. I watched a video on YouTube at one point, and I know other people have, Ron Wyatt saying he'd found Sodom. Have you seen that? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not going to say much at this point. I think that Tal el Hammam is, for a better use of words, the most plausible geographical area. I think it fits the biblical text, the geographical description that I just presented. I think it fits it best. You got to remember, too, one thing that's interesting about archaeology is there's sort of a joke that we make. You know, if you didn't dig it, you don't dig it.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, Dr. Collins have invited a lot of his critics to come to the site. None of them have come to visit. And then some of the other scholars who are sort of like, you know, I want to go look at the site. Let's see what Dr. Collins have to say. In fact, let's join the dig. They're blown away. But some of the diehards that go with the southern area or don't believe it at all, got to also remember that some archaeologists, they believe that it's uncalled for to dig up cities to prove the biblical narrative, you know, sort of like doing archaeology and apologetics. I love that stuff. I've taught apologetics for 20 years. So, I mean, can you think of a better city to find than Sodom just to silence the skeptics once and for all? All we need is a coin or something that says King Bear on it, and we're good to go. So we're not stopping at this site. It's going to go on and on as long as Jordan allows us to do so. But that being said, I think it's fascinating because it not only does it prove or lend credence to the biblical account, it would give us a better understanding of how Lot lived, you know, what was going on during the time of the patriarchs, et cetera, et cetera. So given the established data, I think this site fits it the best. And like I said, the whole argument from Albright and others that, you know, the slime pits is proof that the southern end must be where the city of Sodom was located. You found that at the northern end as well, you know, near Qumran, where the Essenes penned down the Dead Sea Scrolls. But then you also have Genesis 13. That's really the main text before you do anything. The best way to geographically identify Sodom, you don't use chapter 10. You don't use chapter 19. You focus in on Genesis 13. And your readers can do that because we don't have time to do so. But the most interesting thing is, in addition to what I just said about Tal el Hammam, the southern location was conquered. The scriptures does not tell us ever that Sodom was conquered in conflict or war. Nobody beat up King Bera in Sodom. At best, we can say that the city was plundered, but King Bera would not launch a fight or a series of fights right at his own doorstep. That would be stupid. It doesn't fit the way of ancient war, if you will. Like Joshua, you know, you would chase down the Canaanites. You would go to them and spread out and set up shop and then invade them at night. Nowhere would you invite somebody right to your city. Now, having said that, in case you have some skeptical listeners, and there should be, there's nothing wrong with that. What about common warfare and tactics in those days? You know, fiery darts were common. You could light a city on fire from the rooftop down by just fiery darts. But that's not what we see at Tal el Hammam. It's not what you see at the southern end either. The southern end, actually, one of the scholars, I forgot his name, he believes that there was natural gas in the ground, and a combination of a gas leak and earthquakes launching a fire, causing fire, burned down the whole place at the southern end. You know, I don't know what you know about gas, but a gas explosion is not going to blow up a whole city. No. You know, it just seems it's too vast of a claim. It would be like, you know, throwing a Molotov cocktail, just larger, but to blow up an entire city, it's just not going to happen. Sodom was not destroyed in a war. It was never conquered. We see evidence of the southern cities being conquered in warfare. Now, having said that, prior to Sodom being destroyed, there were other people, other periods before that. Like I mentioned, you have the Intermediate Bronze Age, up to the Early Bronze Age, all the way back to the Chalcolithic era. They experienced earthquakes. There's evidence of earthquakes. There's evidence of civilization sort of coming and going, probably throwing warfare there as well. But the last occupation, biblically speaking, I'm not talking about the Iron Age, that was the Sodomites. When Sodom was destroyed, that was it. Now, what about the argument that some people are making, that God would says, I will never rebuild that city, or this people's, they're destroyed once and for all, so to speak. Well, Sodom, Tal el Amon can't be it, because you have the Late Bronze Age, and then you have the Iron Age going all the way up to the Hellenistic era, right? If there is evidence of Hellenists, that's still up for dispute, I believe. I think there are some remains of that. I didn't see any, but like I said, they've been doing this for 11 years. I just joined them on the 12th season. I can't wait to go back next year. But that being said, the last civilization being Sodom, God destroyed them. He didn't curse the ground and say no one else can move into that area. You know, that's just common sense. So, you know, if Roman troops set up shop, you know, because it's an excellent location to have a sort of like a fortified military base in the Middle East. This is an excellent location because you can see people from miles away, and it's easy to defend that site. The walls, or the hillside, if you will, are sloped to perfection. Like you can just take rocks and just roll them right down, like in a perfect 45 degree angle. Sort of like if you were to take a bucket of dirt and just throw it onto your driveway, pick up another one and throw it on your driveway. The way that the dirt would trickle down would be at 45 degrees. The entire mound, the sides of Tal el Amon is shaped like that. So it would be easy. It would be easy to defend the upper city, so to speak. But in any event, Abraham and Lot, before they were separated, went their separate ways. They in Genesis 13, they were at Bethel and Ai, and they looked east. That's in chapter 13, verse 11. And we also know what he saw. He saw the entire plain of the Jordan. That's in Genesis 13, verse 10, the Kikar of the Jordan. The entire plain of the Jordan, Tony, is not at the southern end of the Dead Sea.
Right. Okay. So that's
And it's a little too far, too, I believe, from Bethel and Ai, because you'd have to look to your right all the way down and go, wow, that's well watered. And it's not the Kikar, you know, it's not a huge plane, a big disc that lands right where Tal el Hammam, like I said, it's the biggest occupied city in that entire area. And you can see what the Greek archaeologists have identified, or they believe to be Gomorrah. You can see it. from Dalai Lama. So there you have it. You have the big city, and that you have the neighboring smaller city, which would be Gomorrah, right around the corner. I guess there's other cities that I didn't get to visit, not this time at least, but it fits the description. Why anybody would not? I mean, Sodom's been around for thousands of years. This place has not been excavated until Collins picked it up. And it's amazing. Why not? Well, you got to remember, too, that most of our believing archaeologists, they're on the Israeli side. They're having fun in Jericho. They're having fun in other areas, the southern steppes. And maybe that's one reason why they didn't want to go through the hoops to deal with Jordan and permitting. And it takes a lot of money that you got to come up with. And you got to sell them on this. And of course, Jordanian antiquity, the societies there are going to say, what's in it for us? You know, how are we going to make money on this? So it's a huge paper trail, takes a lot of patience, a lot of trips before you can even set foot and put a trowel to the ground and start digging. And I don't think that there are too many Jewish archaeologists on the Jordanian side, you know, not as many as you have in Israel. And there are plenty of sites in Israel, so I don't blame them. But this place have just been sitting there untouched. And I believe it's a gold mine.
Before we run out of time, because there's another subject I want to talk with you on.
Sure.
When are you thinking, when are you going back to this site again?
I am going, I'm going to say, middle of February next year.
Right. Okay. So is there any way people can help you with that?
Oh, absolutely. Every once in a while when I go on trips like this, it's always nice to get a little bit of help. There are some nice believers that are always supporting me here locally, actually abroad too. Whenever it's time, we launch a GoFundMe page to help us out to get over there. But that's neither here nor there. A good way to support something like this would be to go to our website and get something in return, as opposed to just making a donation or shoveling out money. Buy our DVD, Evidence for the Resurrection, by the way.
Yes, that's the subject I want to get onto now, because that's another one again. Can you tell the listeners about that documentary? It looks like it could be a really interesting one. So if you could just give us a little bit of a rundown on Jesus' evidence for his resurrection, that'd be great.
Yeah, be glad to. You know, Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, he does something interesting there. He does what no cultist would ever do. He hangs Christianity by a thread. He says if the resurrection did not happen, we are men most to be pitied. Why? Because there's no salvation. If there's no resurrection, there's no ascension, there's no remission of sins. So we are men most to be pitied. That's what he said. When you're hanging the entire Christian faith by a thread, it's sort of like this. Tear down the resurrection, show that it's false, and Christianity is hogwash. Very bold for Paul to say so, which tells me that he really, really believed it. Now Saul, later Paul, same guy, he was not a traveling companion with the disciples. He came to faith after the resurrection. When you look at Peter, James, and the rest of them, they were spending time with him. For 3 years, they spent time with Jesus. So they would be the best candidates and defenders of the resurrection. Now, there are rival hypotheses. You know, skeptics and atheists, they keep just bringing up the same arguments over and over again, that, for example, the swoon theory. You know, Jesus didn't completely die on the cross. He sort of swooned or went into a temporary coma and then got well, and people thought he raised from the dead. A lot of problems with that. And I deal with that in the documentary, also in my book. The book is called Jesus, Is He the Messiah of Israel? I deal with rival hypotheses in there, but also in the DVD, Jesus, the Evidence for His Resurrection. So you have swoon theory. If people haven't heard about that, they probably will if they start preaching the resurrection. Easter is just right around the corner. Be a good time to show the movie to your church. But secondly, you know, they're arguing that the women were drunk in the morning. So they went to the wrong tomb, or it was dark and they went to the wrong tomb. Well, I mean, given the size of the old city of Jerusalem in the first century, it was smaller than it is today. Everybody would have known where he was located, what tomb he was placed in. And you got to remember, too, that Joseph of Arimathea, who was a high-ranking member of the Sanhedrin. Now, the Sanhedrin would be the equivalent of our Supreme Court. Everybody in Jerusalem would have known Joseph of Arimathea, sort of like John F. Kennedy, you know, or James Kennedy. His tomb is over there, and they placed Jesus of Nazareth right there. So, I mean, the women didn't go to the wrong tomb. They didn't drink wine in the morning. Yeah, they were sad. I mean, even the disciples thought they were drunk when they showed up and said, "We've seen the empty tomb." They had to go and check it out for themselves. So the interesting thing is, if it were dark, well, they would have found the tomb when it got to be daylight in the morning. So those are two contrary theories. Then you have one ridiculous one, the twin theory by Dr. Cavan over at UC Irvine. He was pushing this view. It's just one of those. I'm going to come up with my own view, and hopefully I can make the history books. Jesus had a twin brother. No history anywhere gives any credence to that proposition at all. Now, Cavan is a philosopher, so you can argue that maybe it's possibly true, or it's a logical possibility. Well, you know, it may be possible, but it's certainly not likely at all. It's not even possible. Mary would have known. Joseph would have known. The disciples would have known. Even the Gnostic Gospels would have mentioned that Jesus had a twin brother. So the theory goes, Jesus was killed on the cross, and the body was done away with. Well, still, where's the body, right? And then his twin sort of stepped in and says, "Hello, I'm Jesus," and the whole thing was just a fraud. The disciples would have known, so they would not have died for a lie. They would have known it was his twin, etc. And then you have, you know, the stolen body theory. You have to look at who might be the thieves here. Well, it would either be the Romans or the Jewish leaders. It wouldn't behoove the Jewish leaders to steal the body and then not produce it, because had they stolen the body, they could just take Jesus in a wheelbarrow or display him in the city and go, "Here he is." And they could have quenched Christianity, or the early the way, so to speak. John 14:6, the followers of the way, the truth and the life. They could have displayed his body. Same thing, but they didn't. So they didn't steal the body. They would have shown the body to quench Christianity once and for all. Could the Romans have stolen the body? Well, they too should have produced the body and quenched Christianity. Nobody could produce the body. Where is the body? Well, and then you got to put yourself into the psychology of the disciples. You know, they were scared, sort of like they had a price on their head. Everybody in Jerusalem is out to get them. They are the, you know, apostate Jews, following this sect, following the Nazarene, you know, Yeshua from Nazareth. And, they went into hiding, for a while, and then they just come back with an unheard of boldness. You know, we've seen him risen. We've touched him. We've eaten, you know, with him. Sea of Galilee, remember, Jesus was barbecuing some fish on the beach, and they didn't recognize him at first, which, by the way, is why Jehovah's Witnesses are dead wrong on a spiritual resurrection. You know, a spirit can't eat broiled fish, and Jesus actually ate physical food on numerous occasions following his resurrection. We call them post-mortem appearances. So it was a literal and a physical resurrection. It is the cornerstone to Christianity. And we believe that we have the tomb. Now, there are two tombs in Jerusalem. He couldn't raise from the dead in both. It's either one or the other. The Garden Tomb is one location. And then you have the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is the traditional location. Constantine's mother, Helena, she went into Israel early on. We're talking, you know, the mid 300s AD, and she interviewed a lot of people. She had a big checkbook. She knew how to pitch the theologians and historians to get to the bottom of things, which is why you have so many churches throughout Israel. She wanted, you know, almost like memorabilia. This is where he was born in Bethlehem. So you have the Church of the Nativity. This is where he was crucified and he was raised from the dead, Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Golgotha. And then you have arguments from the defenders of the Garden Tomb saying, we believe it happened here. It's more like the Protestants also needed a site, seriously. That area has 4th century BC tombs and 4th century AD tombs. There's not just one tomb, and Jesus was placed in a unique tomb, hewn out, you know, for Joseph of Arimathea. You know, he was buried with the rich, so to speak. And the Garden Tomb area was never desecrated as far as archaeology goes. When the Romans came back, remember, they threw the Jews out of Jerusalem, AD 70, and burned it to the ground. And then they came back, you know, in the mid 100s or 120, 130, and they erected pagan temples right on top of Christian sites, erecting a temple to Jupiter, I believe, right there at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, just to sort of desecrate Christianity once and for all. So you have pagan remains built over ancient remains at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, none of that at the Garden Tomb. So in any event, I deal with the skeptical arguments for the resurrection. I give a case for the resurrection. There's a lot of biblical passages that are explored. And it's fun. It's not as go as we're doing now. We're actually on site in Israel, talking about where these things transpired. We deal with the skeptical arguments. We deal with Bible verses. We talk about cults. And also, we establish the reliability of how we can trust the New Testament, how it has not been changed, because that's another argument that's brought against the resurrection. Christianity can't trust the Bible. So we defend the historicity of the New Testament as well. A lot of fun. We were on a boat, Tony, in the Sea of Galilee, and one of the camera guys actually were in a motorboat, and he lays on the bout without a life vest, and we fired up the boat. And I think in that segment, I was responding to Dave Hume's argument against miracles, or Spinoza, who was a Jewish skeptic. And we fired up the boat, and he's literally holding on for his life, filming us as we're cruising around on the Sea of Galilee. Normally, when you go to Israel on a tour, you're in a bigger boat, you know, and you play some drums, you worship, somebody brings a guitar, very, very nice, and you sail from Tiberias over to Capernaum and explore that area. But to be in a motorboat and just fly around on the Sea of Galilee, that was something else. That was one of the more fun shoots that we had.
Do you actually go to both of those sites that you mentioned, the Garden Tomb and the Holy Sepulchre?
Absolutely, absolutely. I want to be fair to everybody. What was great about the Garden Tomb is before they opened for the public as a site, I got that area to myself for a whole hour. So we were there in the morning when no one was there. It was just nice and peaceful. And quiet. It's very clean. It's a very clean site. One of the cleanest sites you'll have, because they have a lot of British supervision and they stay on top of it. Only Protestants that I know would go there. Catholics wouldn't. And I'm not throwing rocks either way. I think everybody should visit both sites. When you go to Israel, by all means, grab 2-3 books on archaeology and Bible history and read up everything the night before, everything you can lay your hands on about that site. And it'll just make the experience more rich. So we filmed at both areas. We start off at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and then somewhere in the middle, we're at the Garden Tomb.
So would this be a good movie for skeptics to watch?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's somewhat scholarly, but we try to break it down, you know, bring it down to earth where it's also fun and exciting. But, you know, theology has its own vocabulary too. So we don't try to dumb things down. We have a historic Christian faith. It actually happened in real space and time. versus somebody dreaming up a religion under a tree, you know, in India, or Joseph Smith, you know, forming Mormonism, digging after gold in New York City, and then ultimately dying a martyr, being stabbed in a jail cell. You know, that's not really what we're looking at here. So, yeah, we had a lot of fun, and it's good for skeptics. It's absolutely a necessity for college and career. You know, we're losing our young ones when they go to secular college. So we got to arm them to their teeth so they're ready, because someone said the barrage is coming. I say it's already here.
Sounds like it's worth it. So where can people get it? Where's the website, and how do they get it?
They can go on Facebook, and they can just type in Resurrection and the number one, not the numbers, just Resurrection One Movie. And that'll take them to our Facebook page on the Facebook account. So just they can type in Nick Kehas. They can type in Resurrection Movie. I believe it's 101.com. Resurrection Movie 101.com. That'll take them directly to the website.
Sounds good. And they can purchase it directly from that website.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the PayPal is all that's set up right now. But if somebody wanted to, if they don't have PayPal or want to get a copy, they can just email us or send us a message on Facebook, and we'll make sure that they get a copy.
Sounds very good. Okay, so we're pretty close to out of time. Have you got anything you just want to add at the end here?
No, just I appreciate your show and appreciate your listeners. This is definitely one of the best shows around. What I wanted to say is, if you have some diehards that actually do want to go and get their hands dirty and go to Jordan and go to a dig, they could just contact Trinity Southwest University and get on a mailing list, email list. I mean, it doesn't cost them anything. And they can support the dig. They can sign up and be a volunteer next year or the following year. Lots of fun. It's affordable. Food is great in Jordan. And on the website too, if people don't like DVDs or documentaries, we have a couple of books that I've written. One is One Way or Many Ways to God. I give a case for for Christianity being the only salvific faith, and I deal with religious pluralism, how they cannot all possibly be true. And it's put in a dialogue format, Tony. So you have two guys debating back and forth. Same thing on Jesus. Is he the Messiah of Israel? You have two Jewish guys going back and forth about prophecy fulfilled in Jesus and skeptical arguments, including the resurrection. So there's a lot of stuff there if this is new to folks. Yeah.
That sounds great. So, yes, I've really found this interesting, and I'm sure our listeners will as well. And, I hope people will visit your website and get a hold of that DVD, and I certainly will be one of those looking to want to do that myself. So, yeah, it's been great to talk to you again today, Nick, and I'm sure it won't be the last time that we do talk together on the A Minute to Midnight show.
Love it.
Well, that was a fascinating interview, and you can find all of our interviews as YouTube videos on our channel, and also as audio-only downloads from our website and on iTunes as well. And we do have a donation button on the aminutetomidnight.com website, which we really appreciate the people that help us out that way. Thank you to those people. And I write, play, and record all the music that you find on our shows. So you can find my music at rockshoresounds.com, and there's a link to that on the A Minute to Midnight website. We also have a Facebook group, which you are welcome to join, and Brooke mainly runs that, and Joni Stahl and I are both in that group and take part in it as well. So that's about it for today's show. We'll catch you in the next episode of the A Minute to Midnight show.